You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Thursday, October 22nd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Daniel Nikanian, the editorial director of the Appeal Political Report on what else is on the ballot. Meanwhile, Democrats boycott the Judiciary Committee vote to no avail, of course. Amy Coney Barrett's nomination now will head to the full Senate. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's debate night, the final presidential debate of this incredibly bizarre election in an incredibly bizarre era. Who knows how it will be. Nashville, Tennessee, 9 p.m. Muted mics. We'll be doing full coverage here on the Majority Report with non-muted mics. We'll be talking all over these guys. Meanwhile, Trump is pissed. Giuliani's having to do it solo. Trump waves firing FBI director post-election. He's trying to keep Hunter Biden from being president, apparently. And with 1 million people having run out of unemployment insurance, Mitch McConnell is still blocking a real stimulus bill. Voting is ongoing in five states. There have been more early votes cast than Trump won in those states in 2016. Meanwhile, Vice reports, however, there are 21,000 less polling places in this country than there were in 2016. Supreme Court upholds Alabama's ban on curbside voting. Federal court upholds North Carolina's mail-in ballot extension, however. And in a Florida polling site, armed guards claiming to be sent by the Trump campaign. New report out of Wisconsin. Foxconn is FraudCon. Company never built what they promised. Lastly, Washington Post editorial says what needs to be said. Let's not mince words, says the headline. The Trump administration kidnapped children. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your being with us. Tonight is the final debate of the 2020 presidential election season. We are only 12 days away now. I guess really less. How do we measure that? 12 or 11? I don't know. It's a week from Tuesday is the election. And of course, we've already noted in the headlines, there have been millions of votes cast at this point. And people will continue to vote. Today's guest has assembled an incredible list of ballot measures on the ballot across the country, as well as looking at specific races across the country that have a outsized impact on the functioning of ICE and Trump's immigration policies, and ones, these are state level races that will have huge implications for issues like social justice. So very excited to talk to him and give you folks some resources so that you can know what you're doing and understand the implications of like how a lot of these policies where the rubber meets the road, as it were, around the country. Yesterday on the program, we spoke to Brian Fallon of Demand Justice, and one of the things we discussed was the handling of the Democrats, and particularly Chuck Schumer's leadership, in regards to how to approach the Amy Coney Barrett nomination. There is, we could spend days talking about why Amy Coney Barrett, as a jurist, is highly problematic for the country. It's going to wreak havoc on a woman's right to choose. It's going to wreak havoc on the right of gay folks to get married. It's going to wreak havoc on a whole on the ability of our government to actually do the things that people expect out of our government, like keep the air clean, keep the water clean, keep the food safe, keep products safe. Develop drugs to maybe even down the line to provide health insurance, not just for 25% to 33% of the Americans through Medicare and Medicaid, but also maybe 7/8 or 8/8 of Americans. I don't know why I chose eighths as opposed to quarters, but all Americans, and something in the form of like a Medicare for All type of program. All of these things are in jeopardy because of Amy Coney Barrett's nomination. But the bottom line is the process itself was fundamentally undemocratic, and the Republicans broke the rules. They want to play by two sets of rules, and they can only play by two sets of rules if the Democrats allow them to. And it was a mistake for the Democrats, in my estimation. Brian Fallon echoed these sentiments as well yesterday, to even show up at these hearings. And certainly the way that it was executed was even worse than showing up. It's one thing they show up and they make it clear to the American public that this whole thing is a sham. It's another for them to show up and have Dianne Feinstein praise Lindsey Graham for it. I think they realized it was a disaster, but here is the Democrats and Chuck Schumer basically doing a short play in which I call a dollar late and what is it? A donut short and a dollar late? I don't know. Dollar late and a dollar short.
I am here to stand with my colleagues on the Judiciary Committee who are boycotting today's committee markup on the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. This is not a decision the members of the committee have taken lightly, but a Republican majority has left us no choice. We are boycotting this illegitimate hearing. The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett is the most illegitimate process I have ever witnessed in the Senate.
That is exactly what should have happened a week ago. On the day they started this committee hearing, that is exactly where every member of that committee should be, right on those steps. Exactly. That is exactly the exact spot. And they should be saying the exact same thing. But how does anyone take that seriously now? When they sat through the committee hearing and Dianne Feinstein praised Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the committee, the one who's orchestrating this entire farce. How do they do that with even a straight face? This was a huge missed opportunity. So imagine just for a moment that that press conference we just saw happened a week ago. And every day of the coverage was referencing that press conference. Today is day one of the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. There are no Democrats in the room because they are standing outside the Senate protesting these hearings because they're a sham. Today is day two of the Amy Coney Barrett hearings. There are no Democrats in this room because they are outside protesting this sham. Day three, day four. And maybe even in this alternate universe, the Democrats on each day are bringing some other stunt, essentially, to get the media's attention, to build to some type of crescendo. But instead, what we've seen is really putting the punchline first in a joke and then explaining the premise afterwards. So that is a sad attempt. And sadly, it appears that Amy Coney Barrett will get a floor vote and will do so before the election. And again, we spoke yesterday as to why, if you punt this, if you were able to get this, and I'm not saying the Democrats boycotting would have been able to do this either, but it would have drawn more attention to it. If you could push this into the lame duck session and things go well in the election, at the very least, you're building enough political cachet to take some steps to fix the problem with the Supreme Court. Like I say, there's a debate tonight. Donald Trump is already beginning to whine about the situation at the debate. Here he is on at the White House yesterday. He is complaining about the mechanisms that are going to be used. He's complaining about the debate moderator, and he's complaining already about the questions. All he wants to do is be able to have a bullhorn and talk about Hunter Biden, and it sounds like it may be a little bit challenging for him to do that. Here is Donald Trump.
It's very unfair, and I think it's very bad that they're not talking about foreign affairs. They're supposed to be talking about foreign affairs. And I think that the anchor is a very biased person. Her parents are very biased. But that's my life. In the meantime, that's the White House standing behind me, right?
Apparently he is suggesting that Kristen Welker is biased because her parents have donated to the Democratic Party. There will be three people on that stage who have donated to the Democratic Party, or I should say whose parents, Kristen Welker's parents, but I believe Donald Trump has donated to the Democratic Party prior to being president. I believe his son also has a parent who has donated to the Democratic Party. Joe Biden, I assume at one point, has donated to the Democratic Party. Of course, he's the Democratic nominee. And make no mistake about it, when Donald Trump says, I want to talk about foreign policy, what he wants to talk about is the trips that Rudy Giuliani has taken to Ukraine and other places, trying to drum up something apparently on Hunter Biden when he is not in a hotel room doing tucking in his shirt, is I think what Rudy Giuliani calls it. We'll have more on that as that develops. And we will be talking to Daniel Nikanian in just a moment. In the meantime, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when they go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. A lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. It can take weeks or months before they get a chance to see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with the therapist within 24 hours. And they do so based upon your specific needs. You will be communicating with that therapist within a day. Very stressful time. Obviously, you don't want to increase your stress when you're looking for therapy by going in person. I don't even know if there are any therapists who are doing that in most places in the country. And it's also very hard to just sort of develop a relationship with the therapist if you haven't already seen one. Well, BetterHelp makes it easier. Once they connect you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time, and you can do so for any reason and for no additional charge whatsoever. They have thousands of licensed therapists. They are all over the country. They have therapists who have specialties that might be hard to find in any other way. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience, like I say, 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, better, H-E-L-P, help.com/majority, betterhelp.com/majority. All right. Like to welcome to the show. Do we have Daniel?
Yes.
He is the editorial director of the Appeal Political Report and has also put together an amazing resource for folks, whatsontheballot.com, which literally has what is on the ballot in every state. And you can find it there at whatsontheballot.com. Daniel Nakanian, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to join you.
So, all right, Daniel, first off, what an amazing resource you have assembled for folks. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the work you're doing. And also, I mean, just I follow you on Twitter, and so I feel like I understand a lot of things that are happening on sort of more localized level. Awesome. Than I would. And the thing that I also think is really important, what you do is you break down issues that are national issues, but how they actually get implemented and on a local level, where to a large extent, that's the name of the game. And so we can debate these things about what ICE is doing, let's say, on a national level, but if we want to stop it, and we want to stop it in a way that each individual have more power to do so, you give us the opportunity to do that. You have a piece up at the Appeal on the Political Report about 12 elections that could curb ICE's powers. Now, obviously, you know, there's a 13th. Maybe it's Joe Biden's, but. In the absence of that, or even in conjunction with that, you zero in on 12 elections. Who's running in these elections? And then let's talk a little bit about where they are.
Yeah, you know, that's a great way to frame it from the beginning, because the thing on ICE and on all these other issues is that for the very same reasons for which people care about presidential politics and who is going to occupy the White House, those same issues actually are playing out to such a great degree at the local level, where so much change is going to happen, and implementation and for criminal justice and immigration issues especially, the federal level only does so much compared to the room for change there is at locally. And for immigration and ICE, what's very important to understand is that jails and the carceral system have really become a funnel into ICE's machine. That's because thousands of people transit through jail in every single day just because of the scope of law enforcement and arrests in this country. And jails are used as a way, as a place, as a captive audience for law enforcement to look for possible people to put on ICE's radar, and for ICE to intervene, arrest people who are effectively already captive. And to some extent, that is happening around the country, but also to a great extent, it's up to each person who's running the jail. So in most places, the elected sheriff, to decide to what extent they're going to abide by ICE's requests and actually going to actively participate. And that's something that's not necessarily been on people's radar, A, because we look at Stephen Miller and what the, right. and what the White House is doing, right? And B, because the fact that sheriffs and all these other local officials have such great discretion has generally kind of escaped us. And that has changed over the past few years, especially in great part because of organizing that has happened by immigrant rights activists around the country. I think in North Carolina, especially, there was such a focus on this issue in 2018 at the local level that it kind of changed the game by raising the salience of the discretion of sheriffs and kind of changing the game around the country. And so what we have now is this is not by no means something that's happening everywhere, right? But we have in very large counties, some people who are running for sheriff on promises to stop cooperation with ICE. So for instance, that takes the form of ending contracts with ICE. A lot of counties have contracts in exchange often for money that agree to hold people for ICE. And that also means very informal modes of cooperation, like asking people who they jail whether or not they were born in the United States and telling ICE, or agreeing to just hold people that ICE wants to hold longer, even if they've posted bail. So that's a very interesting movement we're seeing of people running, saying, no, I will not, I will no longer cooperate with ICE. I will not make my county part of this funnel into the jail system.
What? Why? I mean, I have to say that, like, I've been really, I think, ignorant about the concept of county government, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, to the extent that I've even thought about it, I know that I just remember there was a crew of sovereign citizens who went into Governor LePage up in LePage up in Maine, saying that, you know, the county is the real seat of power, and that's the only actual legitimate authority. And he had to have his lawyers say, like, no, that's not true, Governor. You can't. But why is it that ICE works in that way, as opposed to, say, like, via the states or via municipalities? Why do they work with counties, the county apparatus?
I mean, that it really ties into this is really where immigration and all these other issues tie together, right? The fact that there's, again, such a staggering scope of incarceration, not just because when we think of incarceration, we really immediately think, I guess, of the prison population and how people who are convicted and go to prison. But beyond that, just the numbers and the swath of people who just transit through jail without even being convicted of a felony and ending up in prison. You know, you're booked for jaywalking, you're booked for a traffic stop, even for a few hours. That can have such immigration consequences that it's such a large, and if you add to that the racist and unequal enforcement of even the low level offenses that end up putting people in jail, and all of this jail level system is operated at the county level, which is a whole other problem, because there are thousands of counties and almost no oversight into the jail system, very little laws that govern what's happening at the county level in the jails or what sheriffs can do. And so that's really why county governments are so important when it comes to this. Obviously, ICE does a lot separately that they can do. They can do raids in communities and they can arrest people in other ways. But, you know, ICE only has so much capacity. ICE also has to, when it arrests someone, that person has to go somewhere, and that often goes to jails, and because that's already where the detention facilities are. So all of this is really in intermingled and linked up, and it's very important to think of the big picture.
And so by impacting the county structures, particularly these races that you've isolated, who have been the most cooperative with ICE. Right. So it's not like they don't have to be this cooperative. They have a huge amount of discretion. They have a an enterprise, if you will, that has a lot of synchronicity with ICE's, agenda. You know, I can only imagine like two companies coming together and going like, you know, you make gloves and you make, sleeves. Oh, we should be working together. It's that type of situation. And what, give us a sense of like what, I guess, where these counties are, and presumably they're counties where you have an existing sheriff, presumably, or infrastructure that is amenable to ICE and hostile to immigrants. And I would imagine you also have a large immigrant population there.
Yeah. So there really are two sorts of things that are happening. One is in very blue, very in urban areas that are actually already very democratic, because this issue has been so invisible. There's long been sheriffs, again, in democratic areas, that have cooperated with ICE beyond what they had to do. So in those spaces, it's really been an issue in recent years of raising the visibility of the issue in ways that are kind of intra-democratic. It's so this cycle in somewhere like Cincinnati in Ohio, which is not that democratic, or the county, but the primary was fought between an incumbent who was agreeing to hold people for ICE beyond their release date, and a challenger who promised to stop that practice, and the challenger beat the sheriff and now faces a Republican in November. So that's somewhere where there was already a Democratic sheriff who actually had attended a Trump rally in 2016. So we really get the sense that we're not paying attention to who these sheriffs are. And once you do, in some spaces, that's really enough to already change the game. Or Athens, Georgia, this year is another place like that, where very Democratic county, there's no political reason for a sheriff to be cooperating with, but that's where we were. Minneapolis in 2018 was the same category. Then their second category is suburban, very large counties that are very suburban, that have really swung to the Democratic Party, that are in part because of how, because of the demographic changes, in part because people do not like President Trump. And what has happened there is, again, is an opportunity for Democrats to pick up these very large counties. So I'm thinking of places like Cobb County in Georgia, Gwinnett County in Georgia. Those are the Atlanta suburbs. That used to be Republican, that swung Democratic, and now have Democratic challengers that are going after the sheriffs there, that have been very aggressively helping ICE with what's called a 287G contract, which I won't go into details, but it really empowers law enforcement at the local level to help ICE. So in places like Cobb, Gwinnett, in Fort Worth in Texas, there's this kind of combination of Democratic gains and the raise of visibility of these immigration issues that are conspiring, perhaps, to create change.
I mean, I just it's just so fascinating, because I'm certainly one of those people who, like, have, you know, I don't know, I'm not saying I mocked the office of the sheriff, but it never occurred to me that there was greater implications for a sheriff other than, I don't know. I just, you know, he gets to deputize people. I don't know. And so you have a list. We will put a link to your piece, "These 12 Elections Could Curb ICE Power." You've got Arizona, Florida, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. There's a race there. Georgia, Florida, again, Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, South Carolina, Texas, and a couple in Texas. But people should go and read this, even if your state isn't mentioned on there and you don't have a race, because part of what you're doing is simply raising awareness of how these policies rely exactly on not just an edict from above, but the functional relationships that are on the ground that people can control on a local level.
And let me briefly add that Massachusetts you mentioned, I think, presumably there's a lot of people who are viewing us who are there. That's the perfect example of a very Democratic blue state that has very pro-ICE sheriffs and also state government, which is surprising perhaps to people, but not as surprising if you're paying attention to how this works at the local level. And all of the elections for sheriffs other than one are in 2022. And it's going to be a good test of whether the visibility of these elections are increasing. So if you're in Massachusetts, it's a great state to pay attention to these issues.
Right. And that is, you know, the Norfolk is not, you know, this is where is basically part of Boston and suburbs. And this is not, you know, it's not an area where you would assume you've got officials who are cooperating with the Trump administration in this way. All right. So let's move to you have another guide, which is to 30 sheriff and prosecutor elections that could challenge mass incarceration. Mm-hmm. There has been, over the past couple of years, a real, I guess, burgeoning movement amongst prosecutors, in particular, for, I guess, reform-minded prosecutors. I don't know how else to articulate that, where prosecutors are coming in, and they are coming not from sort of a prosecutorial background, but from a defense background, and are implementing changes to attempt to challenge both mass incarceration and, just broadly speaking, the criminal justice system We have people in Philadelphia, Krasner and Chiesa Bourdain in San Francisco, and others. So tell us what's going on here with these 30 races that you have isolated.
Right. You know, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but it's similar to what we were just discussing. Perhaps even more so because the First Step Act, which was the federal criminal justice reform, almost gets more ink than what's happening at the county level. And at this, but so much of the incarceration rate of what we drugly denounce as mass incarceration is fueled by county level governments again, and by the choices made by prosecutors, and the unequal choices often made by prosecutors. And as you said, we are seeing an increasing number of races kind of fought along these lines, which is still surprising to the extent that prosecutors are such a, like we have this attachment to the idea that to win any election is means to be like tough on crime and law and insist law and order and tweet about it repeatedly. But especially in DA races, right? And the game has really changed over the past few years, especially because of a lot of BLM organizing born from 2014, and in the St. Louis area from Ferguson, that has obviously spread around the country. This summer has really again raised the visibility of all these issues in a way that was already playing out throughout the years. So places like LA, places like Phoenix, places like Orlando, Austin could really join the sort of places you were mentioning that have elected people either with a background that is very unconventional for prosecutors, the background really as a civil rights attorney, an immigrant rights attorney, a public defender, or at least people who are really centering their campaigns on saying mass incarceration is something that has to be confronted with big, bold policies that really draw clear lines and commit to cutting the incarceration rate. That's what we're seeing in some of these counties that I mentioned and many more.
And we'll put a link to that at majority.fm as well. Many of the same counties that you saw in terms of the ICE, but also Colorado is in there, yeah. and a couple other states. And I guess presumably the more we see reform-minded prosecutors win in these races, I imagine there becomes this sort of like cross-pollination. Like in Philadelphia, we have tried this. In San Francisco, we've tried this. In LA, we've tried this. In Austin, we've tried that. And soon you start to develop a basically off-the-shelf policies that have been shown to work and be effective and are not, you know, I think people, I think it's changing, but I think there has been just sort of traditionally like it's been hard for people to imagine. Like, wait, isn't a prosecutor, aren't they supposed to just relentlessly put people in jail as opposed to sort of like have a more holistic approach and not relentlessly put people into jail? And aren't prosecutors just supposed to cover for cops who are, you know, doing abusive things? I mean, I think over time, obviously, you know, activists have a better sense of these things, but over time, the general public can come to sort of redefine the idea of what they have in their heads as to what a prosecutor is supposed to do.
Many places, they still do just what you just said. In most places, elections do not even draw a candidate to oppose the incumbent. We're still in that mindset. But you know, a lot of people I talk to who are running for prosecutor tell me exactly that. I saw Krasner win in Philly. I didn't think that was possible. Why wouldn't I try? I saw this person run on a platform of just saying, I will never prosecute drug possession. I will not file criminal charges against drug possession writ large, period. Why wouldn't I file run with that position? It also allows me as a reporter who interviews these people to push their assumptions, right? Because even people who run expect that they can say certain things. And then you're like, well, this DA in Boston has said she will not prosecute drug possession, to that example again. Why aren't you, Please explain why you still want to do it. Please defend it. And that really has changed the conversation. And, you know, I've really tracked these elections for a few years, and there's been a sea change around what people are even saying, right? There, even reform-minded prosecutors a couple of years ago were still attached to this idea that it's about their wisdom, or like, I will come in and I'm going to come in with a more wise discretion as to how to reduce incarceration, and like, trust me, I have that outlook in mind. But what is really important to demand is clear commitment and policies that will apply across the board. This, like, for instance, this sort of offense, I will not prosecute. The death penalty, I will never seek it. And we're seeing an increasing number of candidates come in with those sort of clear lines in the sand and commitments that really clarify the stakes of these elections by really clarifying that there are different approaches to this and candidates who are committing to reducing incarceration and reducing the volume of prosecutions as well. Or winning in many places.
Is there an organization? I mean, because it's fascinating, this concept of there being an off the shelf or just a more codified platform that a prosecutor could adopt, as opposed to you can trust me because, like you say, I have wisdom or I have good judgment or this and that. As opposed to like, no, here's a set of policies that are indicative of what an agenda I have or what a set of goals I have. And here's a policy here's basically a platform. Are there any organizations? I mean, because, you know, we think about like the Democratic Party, for instance. Okay, so, you know, you're running for Congress. The Democratic platform is sort of a watershed. I agree with this part of it. I don't agree with that part of it, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, not explicitly, but that's sort of the relationship that they have to a party. People go in, I generally vote for Democrats. Boom, I'm going to do that. Prosecutors haven't necessarily sort of your Republican and Democratic, prosecutor, to the extent that there's any partisan recognition of this on a local ballot. It's not really indicative of anything, or hasn't been in the past, right? It's just a question of like, well, our policies are more or less the same. It's just I'm going to execute better because I have more experience, or I'm just a wiser person. But what sounds like what's happening is that, in fact, when you go in, there's an attempt to say like, no, I subscribe to a certain almost ideological perspective here. Maybe a functional one, but an existing platform that I'm going to adopt. Is there any type of organizations out there that are sort of like developing this as almost a subset of the Democratic Party? I mean, most of the people you're talking about are Democrats who are running. I don't think there's a lot of reformers on the Republican side, but clearly I don't know that there's like a Democratic institution that is saying, if you're running for prosecutor, you got to be running in relation to this set of criminal justice reform ideas.
You are exactly right that the problem has not been a Democrat versus Republican issue, because so many of the most punitive DAs in the country have been Democrats in very Democratic places. Like, for instance, the LA DA race this year, which has one of the biggest contrasts, is a race between two Democrats. The New Orleans DA who's leaving is perhaps one of the people who comes to mind as one of the most aggressively carceral prosecutors in the country. He's leaving. So the partisanship has not been the proxy, and that's there's a fiction that prosecutors like to use, that they're only there to apply the law or call balls and strikes. It's kind of similar to how judges speak. That fiction is really exposed for as a fraud when you look at what they're doing at the state level. You know, the DA associations at the state level are the biggest, often one of the biggest obstacles to any criminal justice reform that is proposed at the state level. They have organizational clout. They hire law advocates and lobbyists on their behalf as an association to go into the state capitals and argue against criminal justice reform. So there already has been a politics and ideology of prosecutors that has been very conventionally tough on crime. And what we're seeing is the emergence of obviously ideas that already existed, that the people who are running on these ideas are winning and kind of constituting another wing. So to your question, there are some groups nationally that Fair and Just Prosecution is a group of national, is like a coalition of DAs at the national level that includes people like Krasner and also includes people who are perhaps much less bold in some of their proposals, but that kind of work together and identify together as part of this wing. But the most interesting change that has happened in recent years is at the state level, not in the past few months, I mean, not even in recent years. In Virginia and California, they have been just over the summer, more reform-minded DAs have created counter associations of prosecutors that have kind of banded together. Virginia really is the biggest, I think 12 of roughly 100 have joined, because 2018 in Virginia, 2019 saw a big wave of reform DAs in Virginia, and they've now banded together to promote criminal justice reform at the state level, and also discuss what they're doing internally, as opposed to the conventional group of DAs that is doing the inverse. So we're seeing more of an acknowledgement of the policy preferences and views that is going, feeding into these views on incarceration.
It's a fascinating development, and it's encouraging because, you know, dollar for dollar, people get involved in these races. They're going to have a much more impact than they would if they're getting involved in maybe a, you know, even a congressional race, or they're not only going to have more impact because it's more localized, the race itself, they're going to have more impact because this is where like the rubber meets the road. And this is the last stop. There's a lot of discretion here. You don't need to convince 200 other of your colleagues to vote in one way and then hope that it gets executed down the road. This is it. This is where
huge discretion.
Okay, so in your spare time, it sounds like you have put together a incredibly comprehensive list of the local, or I should say the ballot referendums and questions in as far as I can tell, all 50 states. It is, folks can go and check it out on the ballot.com. But give us, we just have a couple minutes here left, but give us a couple of the key measures that you see on there that that you think are important and why. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So definitely I've made an effort to have every single state and Puerto Rico and DC included at least once for a non-federal election to really show people that there's a lot of stuff happening at home in their backyards, some obviously much more than others. And ballot initiatives, unfortunately this year, there are fewer opportunities than usual to change things directly because COVID, the pandemic, stopped ballot initiatives in many places from being able to collect signatures, but there are still major initiatives on the ballot. So, for instance, kind of perhaps to link to some of the issues we were discussing, Oregon comes to mind immediately for its ballot initiative to that would make Oregon the first state to decriminalize drug possession, which would be a kind of a new step against the war on drugs, still not kind of a final step to the extent that there would be some law enforcement happening, but a very important step to create a different approach, a different model. And as you were saying with DAs, like this is the sort of thing that can snowball, it can have an avalanche effect that people can then look to and be like, oh my God, if Oregon is doing this, let's look at what's happening. Let's import it. California, of course, has a lot of important ballot initiatives. Like every time one that is important to the work I do is the ballot initiative that would enfranchise anyone who is not incarcerated in California. Initiate Justice, one of the main organization that is promoting it or has helped put it on the ballot, is an organization that has been founded around the organizing of incarcerated people And they believe in entirely getting rid of the system of stripping anyone of the right to vote. But this proposition this year would at least enfranchise anyone who's not incarcerated. That's, again, something that has changed a lot in recent years in terms of what the Democratic agenda has been when they get in power, to at least get their state that far, to at least get rid of any stripping of the right to vote to anyone who's not in prison, as an important step. And California could join that. Illinois and California have opportunities to have a more progressive tax system, or kind of scale back the regressive elements of their tax systems. And then there's like kind of the other side of initiatives that would go against progressives. I think California's Prop 22
yep.
is one of the most important initiatives on the ballot. It's a fitting end to 2020, a year where
we're gonna actually be interviewing, I think, Alex Salmon from The American Prospect.
Oh yeah, I read his piece. He had a great piece on Prop 22. So I'll let. But obviously, a big deal. And there's, you know, a bunch of initiatives that will make initiatives harder in the future, which is, I think, Florida Republicans. You know, there was an amendment passed a few years ago by voters to expand right to vote. Florida Republicans got very angry. They passed the poll tax in 2019, and this year they have an amendment, a ballot initiative, to make it harder to pass ballot initiatives in the future, in part as a response to that. So those are the ones. Those are some of the major ones I'm watching, and there are so many others.
And folks can go there. You can see what Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts are also hugely important. We're going to probably understand the importance of those state Supreme Courts even more in the next week and a half, I would guess. But we're already seeing it across the board. You know, the Supreme Courts have been making state courts have been making all sorts of decisions on making it harder for people to vote in certain places, in some places a little bit easier for people to vote. And that is a function of who's sitting on that court. So hugely important. And the site is whatsontheballot.com. Daniel Nikanian, really great work. Thanks so much for coming and talking to
us
about
it. Thank you
so much for having me. Folks should follow you on Twitter, too. It's at Taniel. Is that right?
Yeah, with a T.
With a T. So folks can follow you. And it's, again, really appreciate the work you're doing.
Thanks so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We've got a couple more clips to play in anticipation of tonight's debate that will be taking place in Tennessee. Right back after just a moment. We're back. So tonight there is a debate in Tennessee, as you know, between Donald Trump, who is the president of the United States, if you're not aware of that, and Joe Biden, who is running against him for the presidency of the United States. Tonight, the debate's going to be a little bit different than the first one. If you remember the first debate, there was Donald Trump acting like a raving lunatic, yelling over everybody to the point where at one point Joe Biden said, "Ah, shut up, man." And if you had told me in a vacuum that one candidate has said to another candidate in a debate, "Ah, shut up, man," I would say, boy, that's probably going to make that person seem a little bit unlikable. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of like voters who are sensitive to, you know, the impoliteness and you know, I'm not one of those people, frankly, but I actually think that made Joe Biden more appealing. I think he was expressing the sentiments of a lot of people in this country to just tell him to shut up. And so tonight the debate will have muted mics, and I'm not convinced this won't actually help Donald Trump. I mean, not necessarily more than Joe Biden, but I think like anything that can constrain Donald Trump and keep him from acting like a lunatic is probably in his best interest at this point. However, his son wants to make sure that nobody's muting his dad too much.
Good morning. How's it going, guys?
We're doing well. So your dad has a big night tonight, and the campaign has said they're going to be monitoring that person that has control of the mute button. How are they going to do that?
Well, they're going to have someone in the room, and we're going to call nonsense when we see nonsense. You saw what happened in 2016 when they messed with his mic during the first Hillary debate. You see what's gone on over the last few weeks when it comes to the moderator of the second debate being a Joe Biden intern, sending DMs but actually doing it on Twitter to never Trumpers to try to get some, you know, a way to hit Trump, lying about it, saying that they were hacked, and then ultimately getting caught. This moderator apparently is, you know, a big Obama administration person. I mean, you literally can't make up the nonsense. When you look at the bias that we face on a daily basis, it's literally hard to believe that we are in a free country in America. When you look at that, you look at the media.
There you go. It's hard to believe that we're in a free country when you have a microphone that can actually be muted. But they're going to have a person in there. I mean, on some level, I actually would like to see a sort of an inserted screen of what's going on in the mute room. Because I think that could be actually even more entertaining than the actual debate. I mean, what's really sad about this, though, is the concept that we're going to learn anything about the position. I mean, is there any, I don't recall ever, and we used to bemoan this, ever a time where the content of the debate seems less consequential than tonight. I mean, is it just me, Brendan? My sense is like everybody's just tuning in to see the attitude and the performance of the people. Like, there's no
more spectacle than substance than ever before. You're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think that they're. I don't even hear calls for people craving for substance, right? I mean, I think certainly in the Democratic primary, there was a sense of there were other candidates besides Joe Biden. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren come to mind, who, and I mean, others, too, Castro also comes to mind, where they were running on, you know, a sort of programmatic message, right? We have policies and we have ideas in terms of what we should be doing for the country. Biden obviously has some, he has a platform, but he was running on, I'm a good guy, and I'm going to restore some type of, you know, I don't know, more integrity to the office and a sense of values again to the country, which, you know, I think people want. But it's not terribly substantive, right? I mean, you just go out there and show that you're a nice guy. And Donald Trump hopefully goes out there and shows everybody that he's a jerk. And then we just wrap it up. There's, you know, like and I don't know. It would have been interesting to see sort of Donald Trump having to answer the question of like, you know, what do you think that we should do actually for healthcare, as opposed to just repeating the mantra to get rid of Obamacare. But that is the nature of this era, I guess. And so people are tuning in to see if Donald Trump acts like a jerk. I think he also sort of must feel on some level like that's his only opportunity. So we'll see how he deals with the muting of the mic tonight. But here is Dan Bongino. Now, you may not know who Dan Bongino is. Certainly, even like a year ago, I didn't know. But somehow this guy, if you look at the list of the most trafficked Facebook posts in the country, Dan Bongino shows up there all the time. He used to work for the NRA's TV show. Here he was on Fox News, Sean Hannity, giving Donald Trump some advice on what he should talk about, because there's really apparently nothing else that Donald Trump can talk about.
It was demanding and you got 6 hours to do it.
Yeah, this story is super damaging, Sean. Everybody knows what it's like, sadly, to have someone abuse their power for cold, hard cash. Someone knows someone or heard of someone who's not on the scale. The Biden crime family did it. But that's a story that pretty much ticks off everyone. That's why the left, by the way, and the media are like, President Trump should stay away from it. That's a signal that he should definitely focus on it. But President Trump should do a couple things tomorrow. And I'm not kidding. I'm not saying this in jest. He should bring the FBI receipt with him of copy that they gave to the computer store owner. And he should read out the case number, Sean, because the case number is 272D. 272 is the FBI three-letter designation for money laundering. D means transnational. And then BA is short for the Baltimore Field Office. And he should ask him, he should say, you know, why would your son be involved in a money laundering investigation? Does that have anything to do with the big guy? Does that have anything to do with allegations that money, potentially billions of dollars, was shuttled through Cyprus and Latvia and Privat Bank that may have wound up somewhere near someone in your family? He should also bring the signed receipt for Hunter Biden, who turned over the computer to the store and signed his name to it. And he should say, whose signature is this, Joe? You want to go on the record? Again, I'm not kidding. If they're going to mute his mic, at least President Trump has props.
All right. Thank you both. Good advice from both of you. Up next, Rapper 50.
Now, it's unclear exactly what they think this is going to prove. I mean, the email they keep citing between Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, and I, you know, there's been multiple news organizations that have tried to establish its legitimacy. The only thing that has come out was, I guess, in the Post, like a PDF of the email. And I know that NBC, I know that the Washington Post, they have all tried to go to Rudy Giuliani, who somehow has this stuff, and ask to test its validity. Joe Biden has said he never met with the guy that was referenced in this email. But let's be clear. The email was written 6 months after Joe Biden's out of office. He's out of office, so it's unclear what is going on. Like, what is the crime that's been committed? Other than Hunter Biden using his dad's name to open doors for himself, which is no doubt nepotism and problematic. But it's unclear, like, what's this got to do with Joe Biden? I suspect Donald Trump will try and talk about it. I think that's when he says we need foreign policy. That's what he's talking about. It just seems that Donald Trump might be a tough person to make the argument that children should not be trafficking off of their parents' name to enrich themselves. Anyways, we will be covering the debate tonight. And of course, we will be back tomorrow for those of you who are headed off from our first hour. See you then. And for those of you who are sticking around for more of the show, it's time for me to remind you that your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you get extra content every single day. Also, don't forget to sign up for the AM Quickie. You can do so via our app at majorityapp.com, or you can go to amquickie.com, or you can find it like on Stitcher or iTunes or whatnot. 7 minutes every morning, first thing in the morning, headline news from a left perspective. Yeah. And don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And folks, the pencils in our merch store at shop.majorityreportradio.com are selling like hotcakes. But I will remind you, they're pencils, so do not eat them. It's lead in those pencils, I think.
I don't think they put lead in pencils anymore. They put graphite.
They definitely don't do that anymore.
Oh, well, good. All right. Well, then eat them.
Sam asked for lead pencils, and I said, okay.
Yeah, I wanted them. They're throwbacks. But speaking of the fun half, coming up on the fun half today, Matt Binder from Doomed will be joining us. And
how you doing?
He'll be here. Old Matt is out today. So you guys are going to be going with Brendan. And Kyle is going to be hiding in the background, too. I love
old Matt.
New Matt. Sorry.
What's old is new again.
Yeah, there you go. I got confused.
Well, Brendan Finn will play the role of Matt Leck in this episode.
There you go. Don't forget to tune into Nomi Show at the Noma Key Show on YouTube, youtube.com/TheNomaKeyShow.
Nailed it.
3 p.m. today. I don't know who's on today, but she's had some great panels over this week. So check it out. Jamie, why don't you tell us what's happening on the Intifada?
Oh, well, this week on the Antifada, we are joined by our friend, Pavlos Rufos, who's a political economist and author. He's been on before to talk about the Greek debt crisis. So we just got a little update from him on how austerity is going for Greece. Spoiler alert, not very well. And we also talk about the recent imprisonment of the leadership of the Golden Dawn, which is even more than a fascist party, a Nazi party, a neo-Nazi party that has just been outlawed for running a criminal organization and killing people, among other things. So we talk about the aftermath of austerity, the connection between austerity and financial crisis and the far right, the connection between the Greek far right and mainstream center right, and some parallels between American and Greek far right wing populism. So check that out now, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, tomorrow we have a bonus coming out where we read a couple of interesting articles from some more fringe anti-capitalist sects, including a review by the Maoist Internationalist Movement of Shrek 2, which is a very interesting document of both this Maoist sect and the time at which it was written, being the early 2000s Bush years.
You know, I've just gotten a correction about the mics. The mics are only going to be muted during the 2-minute opening remarks for each of the 6 segments. The
what?
Rest of the time it's on.
Oh my God.
So they're not really muted mics. That's ridiculous.
They never learn. They never ever learn.
That's the way we wanted it. We're going to pretend they're muted. I'm just going to blow through them. As soon as I speak, I turn mics on. Matt, your mic is on.
My mic.
What's happening on Doomed these days?
Well, tonight at youtube.com/Matt Binder, right after the debates. So don't go too long, Sam, and step on my toes. David Dole of the Rational National will join me, and we'll run down the final debate between Trump and Biden. And then, bonus, tomorrow, also youtube.com/Matt Binder, live, Ali Vargas, a reporter, will join me from live from Bolivia. Oh, yeah. And we will be getting an update about what happened in Bolivia and how the Bolivian people voted out a far-right fascist government that was put in by a coup.
There you go. All right. Quick break. These guys will take over. See you or see them in the fun half. I'll see you tomorrow.
In for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dennerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dennerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking...